basically does Weinberg in more detail than Weinberg does. Jane Thomas will link to it so you can have those.
That was my question, and I saw them down on the office.
Oh, they're ready,
right? Well, I saw the people stuck, and so I think they are.
Oh, okay. So it might be that they're ready, in which case, in the afternoon, session will kind of be true. Yeah.
If we found this in the book, it should be on you. Is there someone else that should sign lots of this?
No, it would be good if you put them down. I'm actually finding some, too. There's some thing I'm going through today. I don't recognize those from when we briefly started, and it's true that there was a section we stuck in which has more errors in it than the rest of them, so I'm collecting all the errors because we'll want to, I don't know, just, yeah, it's pretty good. All right, any other questions, or no? I'd like to, at the very end of the last class, so let me kind of remind you of our last class was just a statement of dialogue. It was technically a lie, it's just two statements that which are not saying the major comment they would have been. So remember we had this for spin one, mass is spin one. We had a couple of other things. Where matter means spin 0.5. So what we had was we were using one of these fields which was not a four vector, but it was a four vector optical gauge transformation. So we had to require invariants like this. And the way we were coupling in other things, so the other things, I generically call them phi I, let's say. So we imagine we have a symmetry delta phi I, which we use the same grammar for. And then when we had a continuous symmetry, there was another current, which you could fill in, which is a conserved thing, which was something like the derivative of Lagrange with respect to the derivative of the fields. Okay. Not that, I guess. I'm going to bug with my assignment I told you last time, but it's slightly say proportional to it. So this is the thing that satisfies d mu equals 0 by virtue of the invariance of the Lagrange. So the latter Lagrange. And that was only done when omega was a constant. So we had a symmetry in the sense that the matter Lagrangian had some sort of a transformation like this where the Lagrangian didn't change provided that this was a constant. And the claim was that if the Maynard Lagrangian be, you know, that term for the gauge field plus the matter Lagrangian, whatever it was, plus this current K mu phi times A mu, in many cases this was sufficient to be invariant under this transformation. Now omega does depend on position. And there's might be a sign floating around here. I can't remember what I told you. Depending on what I chose you here, you'd have a plus or minus here. But the idea is that you vary, this is invariant under this. This is not invariant under this. It is invariant if omega is a constant, but if omega is not a constant, it varies by j times the derivative of omega. And so then the variation of this thing, we have a piece of omega j times the derivative of omega from the derivative of a. So provided the variation of this was 0, forbiddenly we had something which was invariant into this whole thing. And then where I lied to you was I told you, so the statement I made, which is not false, is that if this transformation had been abelian, so the symmetry is abelian, and this current is invariant, but it's typically only invariant, the abelianness is sufficient to make this current invariant only if omega is a constant. And where I included things was that I gave you an example of this current for a scalar field where it wasn't a constant. And someone actually after the class asked, this is what it's constant to me, invariant me, and I smacked it down. So that's why I'm telling you it again. So for example, let me do two examples. The thing is, if this thing involves derivatives, it's going to not be invariant if it's not constant. So if our matter of the Lagrangian had been fermion, say something like psi bar d slash plus m psi, if this is a drag permit on the symmetry, it could have been psi opposed to some phase and psi, and that would have corresponded to an infinitesimal transformation like that. And then if you kind of go through and ask what's the current would have been, you know, again, there's a sign here, I don't want to keep that, it would have been basically psi bar I times psi bar down to psi. And if you look at this current and you ask, is it invariant under this? The answer is it is. It's invariant under this. How many colleagues are you waiting here? And you can kind of see by inspection that it's invariant under this because this is the that's not being that's not. The example I gave you last class was for a scalar field. It was you know, E mu phi star, E mu phi star minus lambda, M squared phi star phi. Or I've given an arbitrary potential function, V of phi star phi. Again, the symmetry I talked about was rotating by phase. So the infinitesimal version was I omega phi. The current in that case was something like I times phi star d mu phi minus phi phi star. And this is invariant under this if omega is a constant. But the derivative here, if omega is not a constant, will pick up the derivative of omega, and then that'll make the thing, the variation won't be zero. So the lie was, this is not invariant, automatically, even for Beeland symmetry, you can involve the derivatives of the other fields, as it does in the case of the scalar field.
Do you mean that in your LM, you have a little star too much?
Here? That's a star, oh yeah, right here, two stars there. How are we doing catch points there? So we got a couple lanes, but we're some pennies here, you can see. So if we had done the prescription here, this plus this for the Fermion case plus this, you're done. It's great. If we had used, if the map of the grounding had been this, then you're not done because the variation of this has got a piece which is not being canceled by something. In particular, when we pick up the derivative, the variation of for a scalar field delta j mu, if I plug this into here, I'm going to get minus phi star phi in mu. And so I would need something to cancel, so the variation times A has to be canceled by something. And so what I would need in that case is to add another piece here in addition to this one. So I have to add something, some number, which I won't work out, but you can work out at home. That's phi star phi, A mu. And that, in terms of that, the variation of this I can arrange to cancel the what's not been canceled here. So in this case, for fermions, you didn't have to do anything else. You were just going to stop here. Bosons, you needed a term like this because this thing was varying. And in the more general case of an abelian group, non-abelian group, where you have more than one of these spin one particles, so there's more than one parameter, and the transformations in the matter sector don't compete with each other, then you'll have to add other things like this to make everything invariant. That's I'll come back to what those things are with that. But then one way to find them is just to look at what you've got in the area and ask them, well, what would I have to add? What else can I make which varies in this? And you can see that this has that property, that this by itself is invariant. So that all that happens is you're going to vary this guy. And when you vary this guy, one of these turns into a derivative, and so it's exactly like this kind of form. We could kind of fine tune by not having a derivative here. Because you know the variation came from the derivative of omega, right? That's why that was the derivative of omega. So you can kind of see that if I vary this, I put an extra a times j, so I've got an a mu, p mu omega. The variation of this has the same property. The variation of this thing is a mu times p mu omega, so it's the type of thing I need to cancel. And you can find the terms in a lot of other cases the same way. If you just ask, what would I need to look at the, see how this varies, what would I need to cancel that, and you can kind of bootstrap your way. In that case, in the non-abelian case, you'll have to add terms of the Lagrangian, and you also have to add changes to the transformation function. So you got a lot of piece here. In that case, this will have what would look like omega times A with coefficients in front of it. And once you add that, this will no longer be invariant, so you have to add other things to cancel that. So it's a process where you can bootstrap yourself up to see what the invariant is. And I'll give you an easier way to do that rather than doing anything painfully here on the board. Before doing that, there's a case of interest where really all you need is the fermion. So, you know, if you look around this at the particles, you know, what are the lightest particles in the world? You know, if you look at anything below the electron, if you include the electron in lighter things, then so it's going to be lighter than say, an MeV. So lighter than this, then it's a short list. There's electron. The mass is 0.541. And then there's the proton. So as far as we know, it's massless. This is spin and a half. This is spin and one. And there's there's neutrinos. Turns out there are three of them. So let's call it nu 1, nu 2, and nu 3. And their masses are all less than electron volt or so. Which is all three of them. There might be more than three, in which case there's a whole story you have here, but let's say there's three. There are at least three. So if there are only three, they have to have masses that are less than this. Very roughly speaking. So,
and yes,
sorry, and yes, no. Now we also know that the electron carries electric charge, so it couples to the photon in a way which is carries a Coulomb interaction. And so, because it carries electric charge, it cannot be an antiparticle because the antiparticles have to have exactly the same mass; they have an exact opposite additive charge. And so, this thing really has to be. This carries charge, electric charge 1, or minus 1. So it cannot be a tiny particle. So there's really two particles hidden here rather than one, in the way I was counting them before, by my rod thing. So these ones, for all, you know, these are electrically neutral, they don't give rise to electric fields. And so they may or may not be their own antiparticles. And if I'm only taking them to be three, then I'm saying that they are not their own antiparticles. So let's see that it could be their own antiparticles. Whether they are or are not their own antiparticles is the issue as to whether or not there's a conserved charge that these things carry too. If there's no conserved charge they carry, then there's no operational reason to. It's not useful to think of them as not being around any particles. So what's the most interesting? So one question to ask is, if everything else is heavier than this, and it turns out the next heaviest thing, and that would be the muon. Its mass is 100 odd, maybe
40.
Where's that right? 105 something, 140 something. So it's a lot heavier, right? So in the spiel I've been telling you, things that are, if you have a big hierarchy between the things you're interested in and the things that are heavier, then we should be able to write, and muons play a role in giving us interactions amongst the lighter things. But we can organize, as long as we never look at energy as high enough to produce muons that don't start with any muons, then we can always think of the interactions that the muons mediate amongst the lighter particles in terms of various effective interactions. But I gave you a long song and dance whose upshot was that if we're neglecting powers of energy divided by this mass that we're ignoring, then we should go start to normalize the interaction. So one question is what is the more general normalizable interaction amongst these things? So the statement is so we expect the interactions of these guys given normalizable interactions and energies are much less than the muon mass. That leads to the question, what are the general ones? And so it's easy to write down this case, because we know that in this case, we've got one spin one spin with one particle. So our fields will be an AMU for the photon. We'll have a Dirac spinner for an electron. And then we'll have a bunch of neutrinos. This is a new I using Majorana. It could be Dirac if you like for a long second. Let's see if I write it down. So what I was calling the matter Lagrangian now would be everything. So we know that the kinetic energy for the photon has to be the thing that we found before. We don't just write it in this way by normalizing the field appropriately.
What we knew is just an MU and AMU.
That was coming just from the kinematics of mass of spin one particles. The matter Lagrangian is just these fermions interacting amongst themselves. So there'd be minus psi bar g slash plus electron mass psi minus 1/2. These are Dirac, and so I'm dimensionally not writing a half here. But these are Majorana, so I hope in this you write a 1/2 for this. Mi e slash, and I can always diagonalize the masses and just erase this to think mi. Let's call it m mu I. Sum over I. There is a symmetry in this problem. Because these things are, there's actually lots of symmetry in this problem. I've got a total of 5 Majorana fermions here, 2 of them in the Dirac spinner, and 3 of them that are explicit in the neutrinos. And the kinetic energies are invariant under an arbitrary n by n rotation amongst those 5 spinners. But the masses won't be invariant under those, unless the masses have to be equal to one another. So the things that are symmetries of the masses and the kinetic terms would correspond to rotations amongst the 2 Majorana components of the Dirac spinner, which amount to just the phase rotation of the Dirac spinner, like there. And these guys don't have the same symmetry because if these masses are all non-zero and different from one another. And so there's no symmetry which survives here. So there is a symmetry, though, for the rotating electron, corresponding to conservation of electric charge. So psi goes to e to the I omega psi. And delta psi is equal to I omega psi. And so we can do this little turn, so this little crank here. And the normalizable interaction that we have to write down is there's no interaction that we could have written down amongst these fermions which is normalizable because we saw that the only thing that's For spin zero and spin the half particles, that's normalizable is either self-interaction with scalars, of which there are none, or you compound between scalars and fermions, so there's no scalars. And there's nothing we've heard done involving self-interaction with fermions at all. The only interaction you can have that would be renormalizable involve two of these fermions and a boson. The only boson that can count is the photon, and it has to be gauge invariant to be Lorentz invariant. And so we have to promote this to a local symmetry where omega depends on x. And then we'll ask that the that our whole problem be invariant in that combination. This is invariant already. This would have been if omega was a constant, but the derivatives make it not invariant. And so we have to now add that term there to make the whole thing invariant. And we're going to get a piece for which I got to not be careful what the sign is for.
Why can't you couple the neutrinos to new electrons?
You can't in a normalized way.
Okay. Just because of the interdimensional.
Yeah, because you need at least four of them.
Okay.
And then each of these has dimensions of mass of 3 atoms, so four of them will have dimensions of mass of 6. So the Lagrangian is mass of 4, so you have to couple them. The action was dimensionless because it's the same dimension as h bar, which is 1.
Yeah.
And then the action is the integral p4x of L. And a pair of x is the length. So if the action is dimensionless, then L has to have dimensions of mass of 4 because p4x has dimensions of length of 4.
Why do you have 4 fields?
We'll have to be even number to make the Lorentz invariant because it's got to be a scalar. This is the whole general thing with two of them. And so the only way to get interaction is that I have to have 3 or more times interaction, then I can't have 3 because that won't be the Lorentz invariant. I can't make a scalar out of 3 spins. So N4, and then there's a question of you can make things from N4. And so now I'm going to be more precise about what these parameters are here. Dimensionally, saying this charge is -1, I'm going to now define this parameter to be slightly different. But if I leave this as being omega, I'm going to say minus omega, then it's conventional to write a 1 over a coupling constant here. And then the interaction of Lagrangian will be So if I vary this e times a, I'm going to get my derivative. E is just a constant, not a coupling constant. Here's my derivative, and so the variation has to cancel the derivative term here. There was overall, if I vary psi, I get a factor of minus I here. I get the derivative would be minus I, I get a plus I from that overall minus I. So there's this inside. So I've got a minus on here.
Well, what I'm going to do is this partial minus.
So it's minus charge A and charge minus 1 in this case. Because that's why the definite exponential again, because electron getting negative charge sucks a bit. History. But anyway, so this is the most general renormalizable interaction that you would expect amongst these things. And this is what you do see amongst these things. And this is a huge success of quantum field theory, right? This says that neutrinos don't do squat. They sit there, and they do nothing. And that's why 10 billion of them can go through every square centimeter every second from the sun, and you don't know it, because they're not doing squat. The electrons are interacting with photons, and this is quantum electrodynamics. And this has been tested with 10 death places, and it works. You know, this is the only thing you could have written down for this particle content, is the main message. So that this is why quantum electrodynamics works so well. It's the fact that it was normalizable. This whole business about why... Later on, when we talk about effective interactions, and the argument gets made more carefully as to why normalizable interactions are the one that dominate all energies, that will be the explanation as to why this is the right theory of electrons, and why neutrinos are weakly interacting, and why they had to be that way. It wasn't really a remarkable choice that they had to have these particular properties.
So, I'm still confused. What? Why do you, what, so why can you have one of the neutrinos complete the same way that the giraffe does?
How do you mean we want to write it like this?
Yeah, without it.
Well, we have to write down a symmetry then to that. We have to, you know, this works because what appeared, the variation of this under the symmetry, that symmetry was completely just the derivative of omega times psi over omega psi. And that worked because if omega had been a constant, this was invariant. But if I did that here, I would have to be asking for this to be invariant under delta neutrino is equal to I omega neutrino I. Or more generally, I could ask, is there a choice of matrix, you know, MIJ, which is invariant, under which this is invariant. And if these masses are generic and not zero, then there's no choice of M for which this is invariant, even when the parameter is constant.
So if their masses were the same, then?
If the masses are the same, then you can do a rotation, which is going to be a little paradoxical. But if two masses are the same, and it turns out that there's a symmetry. Something why, since these are Majorana, you have to preserve the Majorana property. Remember that meant that I have to either multiply by a real thing or multiply by I times an imaginary, a gamma phi. And so if I want a phase rotation, it has to be I times gamma phi, say epsilon I j in j. Or this is a epsilon, this is a, 0, 1, minus 1, 0. That would correspond to a 2 by 2 rotation amongst the. If I did the finite transformation, that would say that I'm taking new I goes to an orthogonal transformation of I j times gamma phi and j. And then that would be a symmetry of this, he said. Because the mass, what happens, you remember we did this redefinition in the previous lecture? What happens here is that this mass, the mass matrix goes to O transpose mass matrix O. And so what I'm using here is that if this is the unit matrix, then O is orthogonal, and then that's a symmetry of the matrix. But that relied on, this is the unit matrix if the two masses. So in that case, I would have a symmetry I could hope to. Couple of spin one particles. And then there would be a choice as to whether or not the observed spin one particle we see couples to that particular symmetry, because the matter now has two symmetries. There's a rotation of this thing, independent of the rotation of this thing, and you have a choice now. So if you only have one spin one particle around, it can couple to any combination of the symmetries. Because there's only one symmetry that's being gauged. But in real life, given that the neutrinos have masses, and we know the masses are different, and so the assumption really is that there's three neutrinos and only three. And given that, then we know that the masses are different because that's the neutrino oscillation. And so there's nothing really that they can be doing. Even if the masses are the same, we know that they don't bear electric charge, so that if there's a symmetry there, it's not what photon couples do. Now, if you want non-orthogonal things, you can have things like dimension 5, you can have psi bar, gamma mu, psi, epi mu, say. There's things you can write down about that muscle. So there are non-normalized interactions that can couple these things. And we'll see that the standard model gives you them. But the first order thing, those non-normalized interactions are corrections to something. And the thing that are correcting is that. And that is saying that this is working to zeroth order in 1 over this mass. And the zeroth order in all the heavy masses, things do exactly what they're supposed to do. But the final thing you write down is what you see. And the static model is going to be like that. And we're going to try and do the same thing where there's more particles, more symmetries. And you'll see that it has the property, modulo is one particle you have to invent, that the most general thing you can write down that's normalizable is what you see. Yeah.
So is that a way of thinking about normalizability, that it's kind of like proving a particle from standard normal to or non-normalizable theories? Is that kind of the way to think about what you're doing with normalization? I guess I'm trying to conceptualize.
So the way to think about the normalization is that in real life, when you write down, you don't know what the theory is, that you're two choices. Either you do know the theory of the world all the way down to zero, or you don't. But in either case, you're never actually, in practice for experiments, asking questions about all possible scales. You're asking questions after the scales we have access to experimentally. So in either case, anything you're describing can be described by some more normalizable theory, because there's no content. The underlying statement would be that using a field theory, a Renzinger field theory, having a context beyond the Renzinger and chemotherapy, these fundamental things that we want to live. And so then, if we normalize those interactions, then the size of a contribution of any interaction in that complicated Lagrangian in any observable is if your coupling constant goes like 1 over a mass to some power, then if you calculate observables, you'll find where the observable involves some energy less than the mass involved in the coupling constant, you'll find that the contributions of the coupling constant are of the order of, you know, E over M to that power. And so the statement is that you can have any interactions with anything, it can be non-normalizable, but the non-normalizable ones are telling you about a low energy expansion or something that you aren't really following in detail. And then the statement of normalizability is that the leading contribution, so given that the energy interaction statement is small compared to some other masses, the biggest contribution will be when the power is zero or negative. And that's the definition of the normalizable particle projects. That the dominant thing, if you have a bunch of particles that you're trying to ignore, is always going to be the normalized part. And so then the experimental question is the energy scale you're looking at small compared to the things you ignore? And whether it is or not depends on exactly how small. So if this happens, the bigger n is, the more accurate you have to be to see it. So if m is only 10 times more large than your energy, then the normalizable interaction will work, but it'll only work, you're only going to be capturing, you're only sufficiently accurate if you're working with the 10% level, because then you care about E over m. Better than 10% level means you have to care about single power to be over m, and the normalizable interaction will only capture that. But if the m involved is 100 times bigger than the scale you're following, then renormalizable interactions are a much better description. So the reason that you care about renormalizability is that it is, if you have a hierarchy of scales and you're looking at low energies, the dominant interactions will be renormalizable because of this energy coming out. And non-normalizable interactions may be important, depending if you're looking at things accurate enough to see them.
Yeah. So what is it telling us then that the interactions between them are non-normalizable?
Yeah.
What is it telling us? It tells us that we need somewhere there has to be a renormalizable interaction for neutrinos, but we don't know what it is.
If you see a neutrino interact in a system diagram, then you know how strongly it's interacting, and so you know basically how big it's energy. So you should expect something to happen. This story has to break down before you get to that. So the M you would have found in that case is something like, strictly speaking, you would have found something like 246 GeV in that case. And so that tells you that this theory cannot be the right theory past 246 GeV, something hasn't happened there. And that's the thing, whatever it was that happened there is what would be responsible for the non-normalized interactions you see in the
world. And at that level, there should be a renormalizable interaction that includes neutrinos.
Provided that you've captured all the physics that's relevant to 246 GeV, and that's, so that turned out to be true. There is a particle at 80 GeV, so you'll see the connection between this coupling and the real mass is a little bit more subtle than that. But there was something actually that happened at 246 GeV or lower. Had to happen. 80 GeV, there was something, it's W boson. And if you capture all the physics relevant to the W boson, it is the normalizable, and that is the standard model. And that's why, and the fact that you can do it with the normalizable theory tells you that the next things you're missing are probably quite a ways up past that. But if it had happened that the W physics could not express our normalizable interaction, there would have been some other point where the non-normalizable interactions that you're finding had to become important. They had a coupling which was also going around. That M would have been something bigger than the energy you're looking at. And so somewhere between here and there, something else had to happen. And so renormalizability is a statement that you've captured all the physics for some range of scales, a fairly large range of scales. And so if you think you're describing anything up to a much higher scale than the things that the energy you're calling, that have to be wrong. If you're fully saying that everything is described by zero order and E over M, that's what you mean by that. So that means you have to look for normalizable physics. But if you're looking at gravitational physics, say, or if you're looking at decays of particles, if you put muon in it, decays through non-normalizable interaction, things that are not competing with the normalizable interactions, you can do measurements accurate enough to see them, and so that you can sometimes know that they're there. So in the gravity space, gravity is so incredibly weak you see nothing until you've got, the shitload of atoms pulling on you, not finding any other direction. Or in the case, the muon will decay, and the normalizable interactions were forbidden decay. So that's you're seeing a process which was forbidden in the normalizable case, So that the number for the ERM pieces are competing with zero. And they can only do that at some level with you. So that means that once you see a decay, you've seen something beyond this physics, and you know kind of how far away it is because you know how big the buckets are. And you know why you were able to see it. It was subdominant, but the thing that was dominant didn't do it to it. So you should only expect to see non-normalized interactions in the cases that the normalizable part is forbidden from doing it. And so variant number violations like that. The standard model will automatically predict or preserve variant number. And so, but it's not a fundamental thing, it's just by accident. Normalizable part can't violate variant number. So if you see variant number violation, you've seen something which is repeating the standard model. And the reason you could see it was that it was breaking a selection rule, the standard model has a status point. So it's you shouldn't think that you should never think about non-normalized interactions. Say non-normalized, well, we're orbiting very, very fast, it's very hard. That's why I'm starting to explore here. It's just this, we have this really deep reason for understanding why the really successful theories that we know and love, why they work. And they work because they're the most general things that could emerge in the learning at all, given very general things like the property content and conservation laws. And so QED, Maxwell's equations, had to be the way Maxwell found them, because nothing else would be consistent with the very general principles of the learning. And so that's what I'm trying to pull out here, is that there's a very, very deep. It sounds, if someone says, well, we're going to make a list of things, and the list includes normalizability, you say, well, why do you have to be normalized? It's actually a good reason why it should be normalized. You're making a physical statement when you say the things are normalizable. Not everything is normalizable. That's because not everything satisfies the physical statement that you've got a hierarchy of scales. So, that's still thoughts. So now I have a choice as to order. I skipped something which I'm going to go back to now. That is about symmetries in symmetries, implications of symmetries in general, in kind of a more abstract. I want to remind you of how symmetries work in quantum mechanics. And then I'll come back to the two things. I want to do the same thing now, not for the real particles you see, but if there had been a scalar that carried electric charge, there's an interesting change, because the scalar and self interactions can change how you think about the spin one particle. And that leads to the spontaneous symmetry breaking, which is the something we haven't dealt with yet. And the two things that we're missing are spontaneous symmetry breaking and what to do with the symmetry not abelian. So I just want to get to the statement of what to do. And then we'll do it all again for the standard one. So this is, I'm doing this fairly quickly because you're not going to see it again in the real case of interest. But I want you to see a simple example which does all the things we're going to do so that you can see that we're just doing the same thing again. All right. So, consequences of symmetries. So quantum mechanically, why would it was kind of cool that you have a symmetry and you can make it into a, you can tell you how to couple the spin one particles. But symmetries are of interest for a lot of reasons, and the main reason that they're of interest is that they allow you to make exact statements about processes, and they're, unlike most things that you do, they don't rely on approximations like the curvature theory or semi-classical approximations, they're just exact statements. And so, typically, when you have a symmetry in quantum mechanics, the idea is that you've got some unitary operator, and the unitary operator doesn't change the Hamiltonian. That would be what you'd mean by symmetry. It could be anti-unitary. There's a loophole here. Typically, if it changes the sign of H, then it could be anti-unitary. And that is relevant because what you really want to have for... So the reason this is true is you want to have inner products not change. So if you imagine I start off at a state, I act on it with a symmetry, I get the new state, And I did that for a whole bunch of states. I would like, if this is a symmetry, I'm trying to think that this transformation didn't do anything. And so you're asking for all the inner products to not change. And you can see that the unitary transformations have this property because u dagger u will drop up this left. It's a bigger deal to show that the other direction is true. And the other direction actually, so this being true for inner products would allow this to be unitary or anti-unitary. Anti-unitary things have the property that if I had, u times, I on a state, I would get minus, if I have a complex conjugate, since we have a complex number, I have C star U on a state. That would be anti-unitary. That's allowed, and it's important in only one case, for time reversal. And the reason is that with this condition, so this condition was being demanded because that was, you wanted the inner product to change. This condition is being demanded because you want time evolution to, you want this process to be, you want this to be true for all times. And so you want the action and symmetry to commute with evolution of time. And this is not quite the right statement. What you really want to do is you want to say that u times u minus I h t is equal to u minus I h t times u. And that's almost this. But you see the factor of I here is what allows the, what you really wanted to ask was that u times I h is equal to I h times u. And so as long as your symmetry was commuting with the Hamiltonian, you want it to be unitary. But if you had a symmetry which didn't commute with the Hamiltonian, like time reversal can't commute with the Hamiltonian, I guess I can have t here. If the t were changing sign, then if you want this to not change sign, something else has to change sign. And we never want h to change sign, because h is supposed to be bounded from below. And you can't have a symmetry change the sign of h and still have it be bounded from below, because then if you change the sign of it, it will be bounded from above. So the stability of the system and the existence of the ground state forbids you changing the sign of h. And so specifically for time reversal invariants, you want to have an anti-unitary transformation because you want the change in time coming from the I from this point. To make this be true, even though t changes for the actual symmetry. So although you always say anti-unitary transformations are something you're allowed to have besides unitary transformations, it's often left hanging. Like you could have found, people will generally admit that time reversal is an anti-unitary transformation. But you might have worried that there might be other anti-unitary transformations out there somewhere, and typically there's not, because typically things you're looking at are commuting with H because they keep bounded from below. And so in practice, for everything except for anti-time reversal, unitary symmetries are this is just a thought, start for our kind of screen from this condition. So we want star to be preserved for all t. So that's nice. So why do you care? So if you had a property, supposing it were true that there's two cases of interest. So for the discrete symmetry, let's suppose you had a symmetry, or this is a symmetry for which u squared is 1, for whatever reason. And that implies that u, since u dagger u is 1, that implies that u is u dagger, and that implies that u is commutative. Now the significance of having a set Hermitian operator is that in quantum mechanics, if you have a Hermitian operator, if you have a Hermitian, then this says that H commutes with U. And if you have a Hermitian thing which commutes with the Hamiltonian, then you've got an observable, right? So in this case, U dagger H U is equal to H becomes UH UH U. So U is Hermitian commutes with H. So you can label states by u on psi equal to lambda psi. And you can do that simultaneously with feeling limited with energy. And the eigenvalue of lambda doesn't change in time, because that's the statement that u can meet to h. So if e to minus I h t, so if I take u of psi t, that's u of e to minus I h t psi. So because they commute, it's e to minus I h t u of psi. So that's lambda e to minus I h t psi, that's lambda psi t. So lambda is conserved. If you knew originally that it had that the state had eigenvalue lambda, it always had eigenvalue lambda. If it was true that u squared is equal to 1, then lambda squared would have to be equal to 1, so lambda would have to be plus or minus 1. So you can think of this as being parity or something like that, which is squaring 1.
So you said it's observable because it's Hermitian, not necessarily.
You give me a Hermitian thing that commutes with a Hamiltonian, that's another point. It's something, if I'm looking for my maximally commuting set of things that I want to label tapes, but I can choose that if you want to. So this is case one. This is kind of restrictive, right? This is something which is happens sometimes, but it's not so common. A more common case where you have a transservable domain with a symmetry is when it's you have a one parameter family.
Yeah. I think the question was just that the requirement that it commutes with a Hamiltonian isn't necessary for it to be an observable domain. It's necessary for it to be an observable that label states as to create a basis of the states.
Okay, you're making a distinction amongst the
community. You can make an you can have an observable that doesn't compete with the Hamiltonian.
Right.
It's just not one that's necessary.
I'm not making those subtle distinctions.
Okay.
Alright.
But it doesn't have symmetry.
Correct.
So you're just saying that it, when it commutes with the Hamiltonian, it talks to
where I'm going with this is that if you have symmetries, they give you conservation laws, and there's two cases that commonly where they do. One is the case where u itself is also Hermitian beside being unitary. The other one will be where it's an exponential sign. So there's natural sets of Hermitian things which commute the Hamiltonian when you have symmetries, and I want to repeat on that, but that's what I'm going to talk about. So case two would be very often.
Possible for the printable board.
So that one, unfortunately, doesn't move that. I thought I put it on the moving board, but what I can do is I can erase it. Oh, there we go. So case two would be if it's true that u is e to the I omega q for some q, and this is actually very generally for when you have multi-parameter families of when you have big groups of continuous symmetries, this is actually a very weak condition. You could be a one-parameter family of things, and I can typically define the logarithm of the one-parameter family of things in a way which but this is a very weak assumption. So okay. And where omega is real. And the condition that u dagger is 1 is the same statement as q is equal to b dagger. And so again, u h equals h u, in that case implies q for all omega. Implies that 2h equals h q. Again, you've got something which is Hermitian commuting with h, which is observable in this part of the world. Actually, this part of the world for the hour and a half we're talking, but actually not the building. And again, what I said over there, yada yada yada, still true. If q psi is equal to psi and h psi, then q of psi of t is equal to q of psi of t for all of t. So q would be in this case conserved. So that's quantum mechanics, nothing to do with field theory. The new thing about field theory is that this Q is locally conserved. So that it's not only in terms of the total charge of the universe is conserved, but if you want to move the charge out of this particular volume of space, the only way you can do it is you have to physically move it out of there or in. So it has to come through the boundaries. You can't create it another. And so local conservation carries a little bit more content. And the local conservation means that in addition to this charge Q, you have a current, a local current to find everywhere, which is related to Q, but has more information than Q does, because it's something which is find everywhere. And so the existence of this local current is useful already in this coupling and seeing how it things couple to spin one particles. But it also plays a role when we talk about Goldstone's theorem. So this current is this current that comes with field theory is important. Can I use that word now? Field theory. There's two really two important things. So the first thing is conservation is not local. And so I've already shown you that there's a current J mu satisfying. So I think it's a subtotal equals zero implies the current J mu satisfying D mu J mu is zero. And the reason that that's conserved is that if you imagine you find Q to be the integral, P3x, J0, over all space, over some region of space, let's say. So here's a region of space. Here's your region. And if the boundaries of this region do not change in time, then dQ dt would have been, the integral over sigma P3x of dJ0 dt. And this statement is just saying that dj not dt plus dj is equal to zero. So this is just minus the integral, dpx dj. And by Ohm's law, this is minus the integral of the boundary of sigma. The normal derivative of j. So that expresses that the only way you can change the charge in this region is to have current flowing out from boundaries. So that's why it's local conservation. And this Q was exactly the Q over there. And mechanically, if you thought of these being operators, here's an operator both for fields. The equation of motion for the fields will apply an equation like that to the operator. You can build this operator by integrating over all space. And this operator will have the property that if you commute it with other things, it'll do what Q is supposed to do in the quantum mechanics. So for example, the claim is that if I take if u is equal to e to the I omega q, and if the symmetry, let's say the symmetry was delta phi is equal to I omega phi, in other words, that's true. And the claim would be that, in other words, phi goes to e to the I omega phi. And the claim would be that this u dagger phi u is equal to e to the I omega phi. So the action of this unitary transformation really is the symmetry transformation. In the same way it was over here for the quantum case. It's often true that the so why do you care? One reason why you care is, so let me leave this hanging now. So the one new feature in a field theory was you have this conserved current. We've already seen that current can be useful for coupling to spin one things. We will see later on that it's also useful in implying things like the existence of massless particles once we talk about spontaneous energy breaking. But the second way in which field theory changes is that is to do with this conservation law that we're talking about here. So we said that we can label states. This Q we can use to label states. That labeling is conserved in time. That's that's the statement that you normally, you know, if you have an atom rotation, it's rotation invariant, all the things with different third form magnetism have the same energy because they're all related by symmetry. The symmetry phase with H, so they have to have the same energy. Things will fall into multiplets that are all of exactly the same energy when they're related by symmetries, is the another way of saying this. And I'm about to show you an example in a field theory where that becomes false. So in a field theory, you would have thought that if we had a symmetry like this one, which relates to real and imaginary parts of the scalar field, then we should have always expected that the mass of the energies of the particles that are created by the real and imaginary part of that scalar field should have exactly the same energy. And so for a given momentum, that means it should have exactly the same mass. So the whole story here about things being related by symmetries, having, you know, so if I have states that are related, if the symmetries can connect these states, they have to have exactly the same energy. And things having different energy cannot be related by symmetry. That's what comes from quantum mechanics. When specialized field theory, you're expecting it to have the consequence that when applied to particle states that are related by symmetry should have the same mass. And that's going to turn out to be false in general. Often true, but not always true. And I want to feed on the loophole in the statement that between getting from the quantum mechanics to the field theory, why it could be true that there's an assumption being made when you conclude, when you go from this statement, which is true of quantum mechanics, and apply to particle states, you make an assumption which is not always obvious that you're making. And I want to make that assumption explicit so you'll see why the assumption is being broken later on. So the second, states, particle states, which are related by symmetries, they often have the same energies. Not always. We should yeah, it sound like that was a very safe given that quantum mechanics tends to relate to the same energy. So what would it take to have the same energy? So if we have, let's say we have a field phi 1 and phi 2, and let's say that the variation under the symmetry of phi 1 is phi 2. So you think of this as being, if I took this transformation here, I wrote phi 1 was, phi was, the complex field phi was phi 1 plus I phi 2. And I did this transformation here, what I would have found was phi 1 plus I phi 2. Hit the red marker to there conventionally. Then if I apply this to this, what I learn is that delta phi 1 is I phi minus phi 2. Delta phi 2 is phi 1. So it's a rotation. An orthogonal rotation in a 2 by 2 space spanned by phi 1 phi 2. That just says that O2 is the same as U1. So I'm thinking of this as being a special case of that. Well, this is true, and the fields, you know, the fields are given by sums over integrals over D3P, wave functions. Let's give them some spins, E to the right, X, A, P, sigma, and I. So I is later than particle type. We have some field expansion like that. Then this kind of a statement corresponds to the same thing being true for the great generalization operators, that delta A, P, sigma, one is equal to A, P, sigma, 2. Or another way of saying that would be that U star A, P, sigma, 1, U is equal to A, P. So now let's try to make the argument why they should have the same energy. So what we like to have, so the particle state, so let me just use this as a note, particle created by If article type 1 is somewhere in the center, here, sigma 1 and sigma 2 don't denote spin at all, they just denote phi 1. Phi
this is supposed to be three labels. This is not a subset of sigma. This is momentum p, spin sigma, and then label 1 or 2. So particle 1, what I'm looking at is really something with momentum p, spin sigma, and particle type 1.
Okay.
That would be the thing I get by acting in a no particle state by the creation operator. And particle 2 is going to be the same thing for particle creation operator 2. Now, if I could conclude that U acting on this state was equal to this state, then I would have to conclude that they have the same energy because of the same argument I gave here, right? If U commutes with H as it does with symmetry, then this shows you that if I take two states, I didn't actually show that to you, but I should okay, parenthetically show that to you. If just a slight change, this would be if psi is given by U times phi for two states, then the same argument says that the energy of psi has to be equal to H U phi equal to U H phi because it commutes. So that means that states that are related by the symmetry have to have the same energy because the symmetry being a symmetry means that it's commuting with H. So it seems just so seductive that if we know that these creation operators are related by the symmetry, if we could use that to conclude that these things are related by the symmetry, we'd have to conclude they have the same energy. But the thing that we're assuming is that this no particle state doesn't see the symmetry. So if you do a symmetry transformation on 2. So,
yeah, it lines up
all the way down. So, you, I want to have you writing on 1. I think you on P, sigma 1. That's U times A star, P sigma 1 on the ground state. So no one can stop me from running U, A star, U sigma 1, U star, U. And this thing is just, U star, I'm changing dimensions only halfway through. I want to do better here, yeah. This will be a lot easier if I just make this a... There's two things I should have told you, actually. Star, my convention of star versus dagger is typically, if it's an operator in a Hilbert space, and there's only one of them, they're the same thing. But if I have a column vector full of operators, O1, O(n), then dagger will mean permission conjugation, it transpose this column vector in addition to taking the permission conjugation in the operators. So for the purposes of this conversation, star and dagger are the same thing. But there's a convention as to whether or not I think of U or U dagger as being the symmetry. And the way I've written things here, I'm going to be deriving over here that U star is the thing that takes one state to another. So let me just define U to be the thing that did that. And then if I do that, and this star would have been... No, oh, yeah. That was right. So don't change anything. So if I take star on this, the rule is I change the order and I take the star, right? No, so that's wrong. Yes, yeah, so that's right. This would have been U star, A star, U. Yeah, it's not right. Now I've made this you can't read what stars are, so now I can't draw. So this is now U star. It's just a conventional statement. I just start to put that. So the point of this is that this is the thing over there that's A2. Star. So this is A, P, sigma 2. So if this was equal to 0, if this was this, then we're in fat city, right? So if U on the ground state is equal to ground state, then there's no particle state. Then we conclude that U on P sigma 1 equals P sigma 2. Then we conclude that they have the same energy. So
So the M1 had people in to forgive them at that.
Did you look there in the same energy? You lost your U on the 5 and it became just 5. Shouldn't be E on
5. Yeah, you're right, it's a sign here. Nice. The rain. So you see the logic is that there's an assumption in the field theory case that if it's true that the known particle state is invariant for the symmetry, then it's true that having a symmetry relating to fields implies that the particle states are also related to each other in the way that we were thought in quantum mechanics, and then that automatically implies that they have the same energy and so they have the same mass and all of those things. But it's not a trivial, in quantum mechanics of a finite number of degrees of freedom, this is always true. So the ground state is always is never degenerate. It's never more than one. If this is not equal to this, it's equal to some other state, and then that has to have the same energy because they're related by symmetry. So the issue here is the ground state degenerate? And in for ordinary quantum mechanics, it normally is degenerate. If you had a potential which was like this, which is supposed to be exactly the same energy, it looks like there's two minima, but you know there's a symmetric state. Function, and that the tunneling between these two things puts these things in this really only unique ground state, which is the symmetric one. So typically in quantum mechanics, this is true, and so there'd be no story here. But because there's an infinite number of degrees of freedom in field theory, or in practice a large number of degrees of freedom, the tunneling, a small amount of tunneling per mode becomes gives you a very small probability of tunneling, and so once you get your particle around mode, you can make this your tunneling rate and the tunnel curve small. And so if many things have to tunnel from one back to the other, then the splitting you get from the tunneling can be very, very, very small. And in practice you have degenerate states. And so in practice, this may not be true. Symmetry in this case might have been reflection around this origin here. And it might be true that the ground states in that case really are non-invariant. And if that's true, then this conclusion that the particles have the same energy would be upper grounds. And so what I haven't got to yet is there's a good reason why. So if the tunneling is small, then the symmetric and the anti-symmetric state are the same energy, but they're also the same energy as the states that are localized on one side or the other. And so it sounds like you have a choice. You could have chosen the symmetric one, the anti-symmetric one, the one here, the one there. And again, it's locality or custody boundaries which forces you to choose things for field theory that they're localized in one level or the other, and you can't take a symmetric combination by anti-symmetric combinations of that. And that's the story which is in the notes that you're going to get from the other class, I think. Which I can expand on later. But it's a statement that fields, to have products of fields factorized when they're spatially separated, you need to sense the ground state has to be an eigenstate of fields. And it can't be linear superpositions of field magnitudes, because then when you start separating them in space, you wouldn't be getting amplitudes which factorize. So there's a story there where whose bottom line is that this need not be true in field theory. So that was a long sonic ads. So let's do an example where you see that can happen. So I'll just start this and I'll finish it, but I want to set it up to pick up in the end. Unless this question is good here. This can be the most quartic So one night's writing. So it's all right. Then there's kinetic energies all around. So we have minus. I'll write it d mu minus I, d mu I star. And that's it. So you see what this is if, V is, if it's normalized, it'll V has to be quartic. So this could be A, B, pi star pi, C, pi star pi squared. And positivity will require, you know, C to be positive. And what I've written here is you can see the thing linear. If I expand this out, the thing linear in A will have A times pi star times derivative of pi. Then there'll be a derivative of pi star times A of pi. And that's the term that they're looking at up here involving the current times A. But then there's also a term here, which is A pi, which is the term that we needed up there to make the thing invariant because the current wasn't invariant because the current was all the derivative. The derivative wasn't invariant, the transformation was something which is varying in space and time. So this is capturing the things I told you need to have when you couple these things together. And this is the more general way to think about it, that the derivatives are coming together with A. And because it's the failure of this thing to be invariant when I differentiate omega is being canceled by the fact that A shifts by a greater. So this is called covariant derivative. So, now if there's two cases which I want to focus on, and they depend on the sign on B. So I told you that C has to be positive so that V is bounded below.
Yeah. Are you going to
I gotta do what?
Do half halves.
Am I going to half halves, yeah. Why, what was I supposed to do?
I just have to put your class in half.
Well, this is a good place to break it. This is what I saw now. I'll pick this up in the answer. Then the point will be that if B is positive, the story that we talked about so far works fine. If we expand in powers of pi, you'll see that we have a massive particle for pi, we have a massless sigma particle. But when B is negative, which is allowed by all the conditions we use so far, you'll see that there's an issue now in identifying what the particle in perturbation theory, what the particle is. And the issue there will be exactly the same as the ground state of the variance.
So, does that mean that if the ends here for the neutrinos were negative, you could actually have a symmetry of the gap? The symmetry of the neutrinos, then you could have some gauge interaction between the photon and the neutrino.
Well, for the Fermion, remember, there was no assumption that you could always change the sign of the Fermion. I was always able to do that in one of the time problems, so you can always do the diagonalization of the mass term allows you to actually change the sign of the moment. And that corresponds to your gamma phi, because your psi goes to EDI gamma phi psi. For EDI gamma phi times the parameter times psi changes the sign of the mass free. Okay. So there's no visible significance of the sign of the mass.
So there would be absolutely no way.